You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is your host, Stephen Novella. The following is a special episode that we recorded while we were in Edinburgh in Scotland. We were hosted by the Edinburgh Skeptics and Richard Wiseman, who lives in Edinburgh. He is a social psychologist and an excellent author, science communicator, and skeptic. We had a lot of fun. This is a great episode, and I hope that you enjoy it.
And they're all in conversation with the amazingly great Richard Wiseman. So thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you very much, all. Wonderful. And welcome. Welcome to our event here. I think we're going to run for about 40 minutes, then have a break, and then have another 40 minutes of Q&A. So welcome. Welcome to Edinburgh, as we say. So first of all, we're going to whip down the line. I haven't told you this. We're going to whip down the line. If you can introduce yourselves and tell us your favourite toy as a child in one sentence. Favourite toy, who you are, favourite toy, and I will use that as a basis of a sort of psychoanalysis. I'm just making that up. Anyway, favourite toy.
Evan Bernstein, of course, and favourite toy when I was a boy was Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Ooh. Thank you. Yes, yes. Oh. Jay Novella here, archery, you know, bow and arrow.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, just archery, because that's not a toy, that's an activity. So was there a toy called archery?
No, there wasn't.
Okay, but you enjoyed doing archery.
Right, you want me to pick a toy?
Yes.
Well, that was the question, so yes. Yeah. So there's Rock'em Sock'em Robots, as I'm assuming, is a toy.
That is a toy. Okay. Right. You heard the applause.
Yes. Well, no one here will know what Rock'em Sock'em Robots is, believe me.
Why'd they applaud?
They're an easy crowd. Look, they just... Seriously, do you know what Rock'em Sock'em Robots is?
Yes.
Oh, you're American. Okay, right.
How about
this is going so much better than I anticipated.
Let me show you what it is. This is what it is. Ready?
Oh, Rock'em Sock'em Robots. I know. Okay, I don't think it was called Rock'em Sock'em Robots here in this country. It was called something. I've seen adverts for that. Sorry.
Raving Bonkers.
Oh, I like that better.
They're Raving Bonkers.
That's
great.
Better. That's
yes.
Better.
This is the first 40 minutes. Is us just talking about that. Do you want to go with an actual toy? You're happy with archery?
How about Atari?
Atari? Atari what?
It's a video game.
Okay.
A system.
Yes.
System.
Right. You had that when you were a boy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I still am a boy.
Right, I'm just because I had that when I was middle age, which was the age gap between us. Right, okay. Okay, that's very good. Very early sort of, okay, very good.
I'm Kara Santa Maria, and I think my favourite toy was Teddy Ruxpin.
Oh,
did you now guys that, have Teddy Ruxpin?
Yeah, that was it was a teddy bear, but it was also a pornographic doll where you could have sex.
No.
With, no.
It was basically a teddy bear with a tape deck in its belly, and it would tell nighttime stories, and its mouth would move. But when I discovered that I could put like an Iron Maiden tape in it, and it would just like rock out.
That sounds really... We didn't have any toys like that in this
really?
Country. No.
Just none in this country.
None at all. No. nothing as sophisticated as a teddy with a... That's fantastic. I'm liking that.
I'm Steve. Depends on the age, but if we go really, really young, I think I'd have to say a big wheel.
A big wheel.
You guys have those big wheels?
Yeah. We have big wheels.
Remember The Shining? The Shining, when the kid's riding around the hotel? That's a big wheel.
Cool. Oh, what's that? It's like a tricycle or something.
Yeah.
With a big wheel.
But cooler.
I assume it got a big wheel. Has it only got the one plastic. Big wheel and two small wheels?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good.
Hi, I'm Bob. How are you? My favorite toy, very young. I remember being inordinately fond of Freddy the Magical Talking Flute. Who remembers that?
What?
H.R. Puffin stuff? Yeah. Come on, his flute. I remember loving that.
That's what you called it, Bob?
Yeah. Somebody had to say it. Just for a very
now,
brief
Richard,
time.
Because you busted my ass, that's not a toy, that's a TV show.
Oh.
Well, okay. But the flute was the toy. You had the flute.
You had the flute?
Yeah.
That's a musical, he gets off on the
technicality. That's a musical instrument or an activity. That's not a toy.
Oh, yeah. So it's a flute that does what?
Well, on the show it talked, but it was just a flute you can play. But it was a toy flute with a face on it, and it was gold. I don't know.
From a Freudian perspective, that's a fascinating choice.
I thought you would run with that.
George.
Hi, I'm George. My favorite toy, no question, Lego. Tons and tons of Lego. Tons. And I've been told, not Legos, but Lego. Americans say Legos, and then we get laughed at when we travel the world and have a song with the word Lego in it. So it's Lego. Yes, tons of Lego.
But it's changed. It's very hard to get, like, basic Lego now. You have to buy it in, like, kits of shit.
It's all, like, two pieces now.
That's right.
Like, the Death Star and then the guy. And you're like, that. And that's it. Yeah, they're very specialized.
It's not like Gada. So, yeah, no, I'm with you on Lego. Good. I think we've got a fantastic insight. Ladies and gentlemen, the SGU, George, a round of applause, if you will. Of Mr. Lego at the end there, I believe you're going to kick us off with what we're going to refer to as a wee song, which is, that's a little song for you guys. So George, over to you in your own time.
A wee song as opposed to a song about wee, which is a very different thing, but that's up to you to decide. This is a true story, or these are true things, or take it how you want it. You don't know what you think you know. What you think you know is often wrong. You don't know what you think you know, but you could know what is in this song. You don't seal in juices by searing meat. You don't get headaches from too much MSG. There's a 50-day shelf life for each Twinkie, though you probably thought they'd last an eternity. The historical Buddha was not a fat guy. Sharks can get cancer before they die. And though some textbooks say it's true, the blood in your veins is at no point blue. You don't know what you think you know. What you think you know is often wrong. You don't know what you think you know, but you could know what is in this song. Let them eat cake was never said by Marie Antoinette. Marco Polo did not bring home spaghetti. Just because dogs pant doesn't mean they don't sweat. The pads on their paws get a teeny tiny bit wet. Bats are not blind, they have limited sight. Did you know Napoleon was of average height? The Chevy Nova was a hit and did sell in Mexico and Venezuela as well. You don't know what you think you know. What you think you know is often wrong. You don't know what you think you know, but you could know what is in this song. Edison did not invent the incandescent light. Ford did not invent the car, build the first assembly line site. And how about James Watt? Did he invent the steam engine? Not. And though I know that you say that you swear you've seen it, George Washington Carver did not invent the peanut. You don't know what you think you know. What you think you know is often wrong. You don't know what you think you know, but you could know what is in this song. Sugar does not cause hyperactivity. Rust does not cause tetanus. You see, if you want to wake to sleep, walk or hay, feel free. Hair doesn't grow thick after it's shaved off. Cough medicine rarely ever helps a cough. Folks go on and on about the Parthenon, but the golden ratio is never ever drawn. You don't know what you think you know. I said you don't know what you think you know, but you could know what is in this song. Albert Einstein never failed a single math test. A cop doesn't have to say he's a cop if he's pressed. Milk doesn't cause phlegm to come up out of your chest. Lemmings don't kill themselves, who to guess? It's okay to crack your knuckles, no damage will be done. You can taste every taste everywhere on your tongue. Let me say one thing, no one can rebuke. A vomitorium's an exit and not a place to puke. You don't know what you think you know. What you think you know is often wrong. You don't know what you think you know, but you could know what is in this song. Marconi did not invent the radio. Did Thomas Crapper invent the flush toilet? No, no, no. But using their brains and persistence, they improved stuff already in existence. And yet, for some reason, this myth remains that human beings only use 10% of their brains. Humans use 100% of their brains. Humans use 100% of their brains. Please stop saying humans only use 10% of their brains. Seriously, if there's one thing you should take away from this very silly song, is the simple fact humans use 100% of their brains. Key change, you don't know what you think you know, but now you know what you think could be wrong. Now you know what you think could be wrong, cause you listen to all of the stuff in the song. And now we're all slightly less wrong.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you very much, George, kicking us off in that wonderful way. We are here to talk about Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, how to know what's really real in a world increasingly full of fake, which is available in the break and afterwards as well. Before we get into talking about the book, you guys have just been at QED in Manchester. Do we have any people at QED here? Okay. Oh, some folks here. Okay. Which the rest of you don't know is a sort of big skeptical meeting down in Manchester. And so obviously you attend and organise skeptics meetings in America, and now you've been to QED and a few events over here. Well, what's your impression of British skepticism versus American skepticism? Any similarities, differences? What do we think?
Basically the same in terms of content and, you know, what people talk about and what people are interested in. I think the QED attendees are just nicer.
Nicer than what, the Americans?
Than Americans, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Nicer.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, our baseline is New York.
Yes.
So yeah. You got to take that into consideration. Yeah.
Oh, what do you mean by nicer? They're just friendlier.
Friendlier.
Extremely accommodating. They want to make sure that we're taken care of, you know, like waiting on us hand and foot practically. And you don't quite get that.
Courtesy. The courtesy is impressive. Yeah.
What you might, there's a big sort of strand of sort of sarcasm in the UK, so you may be mistaken. Some of those comments. But, oh, that's nice to know. Well, that's very good. Yeah. Very good. Well, welcome. And we're very glad that you made it over. So the book is out, very exciting, a very big book it is, there's a few hundred pages in there, fantastic. So if somebody doesn't want to read it and they're gullible, you can sort of hit them with it, so that's good. What was the most fun about putting this together?
Fun.
What was the most enjoyable thing? Was there anything enjoyable about putting this book together?
Finishing it. Like, actually, this is the most fun part. Because it was, you know, I mean, it was, you know it's hard to write a book.
I do. You know? I get other people to do mine.
Oh, we did that too. Steve wrote it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. There we go.
No, but there was a lot of collaboration. That was fun. I just, like, whenever, like, the five of us get together and brainstorm and talk about stuff, that's a lot of fun.
So what was the process? How did you go about it?
So we arced out the book together as a group.
That was a fun conversation. Remember trying to come up with that?
Yeah, we came up with all kinds of crazy shit. Most of it didn't make it into the book. But it was fun. Yeah. So then once we had like a list of, all right, these are the 50 topics we're going to cover. These are the different sections. This is what we're going to do. Then everybody got their assignments. All the chapters got submitted to me for editing, and I had to rewrite everything in my own voice because they wanted like one consistent voice throughout and one consistent narrative throughout the whole book. So except for their individual adventures, everything was sort of written in my voice, but they wrote a lot of the chapters, you know, essentially the first draft of many of the chapters.
And the good news is it's been very well received. I was looking on Amazon, and you have many a five-star review. Mm-hmm. It's just fantastic.
We have one-star review.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know what happened. I was looking at it, and I thought, no, really, one-star review. I'd love that.
Yeah, the publisher emailed us and said, hey, it's you know, everything is going great. You know, everything's going great. Everything's awesome. You're awesome. You guys are so awesome. But I just thought you'd find it amusing. Basically, some jerk left you a bad review. So I read it, and he's very upset that we think the Earth is warming.
Climate change. Right.
Yes. Doesn't want to accept it. He's like, you're not giving the other side a chance.
Okay.
That was his comment.
You shouldn't feel too bad. When on one of my books, I had a one-star review. The one-star review was, I've already read this. Which I thought was insulting at two different levels, actually, but still. So I'm surprised you haven't attracted more of from those communities. I mean, there's many a community you're trying to upset.
It'll come.
That's usually our experience, like with our podcast, with my Great Courses. It's like five in one reviews. Like, either you're a skeptic and you love it, or you're not, and you're like, oh, these guys are scientism or whatever. Yeah. You know, they say to themselves. So that's usually what we see.
Okay.
But more fives than ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a big book. It's a big book. And what I was going to do is have some folks here, or in fact one folk, to shout out a number, and I was going to look up that page, and then we're going to talk about what was on that page.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, good. So we need one folk to shout out a number between one and, it's a big book actually, 461. So give me some. Sorry? 42.
We should have anticipated.
Yes.
There are several people.
42. Okay. So, Oh, that's okay. So it's Richard Wiseman's contribution to skepticism. So it's not that at all. It is about pea zombies. Mm-hmm. Pea zombies. I don't actually know what pea zombies are.
These are dangerous. These are really dangerous.
They urinate on you as they, you know.
Yeah, before they bite you, they basically are like saucing you up with their own pea. It's disgusting.
What's a pea zombie?
So here's the real answer. The P is for philosophical.
Okay.
So it's a philosophical zombie. The idea came from David Chalmers, who's a philosopher of the mind, and he says...
Should I eat him? What does it really mean to eat a human brain? Is that what you mean? Or
no.
Philosophically?
No, to eat or not to eat. The idea is that, you know, why do we experience our own existence, right? Why is there qualia? Why do I taste tastes when I eat? Or, you know, why is there some experience of color or feeling or whatever? Rather, because theoretically, an organism could do everything that we do with all of the survival advantages of what we do without actually experiencing it, right? That would be a pea zombie, the creature, the theoretical creature that could do everything we do but does not actually experiencing it.
Okay. And that could apply to an artificial intelligence, couldn't it? Because how do you know this is really a sentient being, a sapient being like we are, or do they experience any qualia like we do? Like, is red really red like we see red or not?
We may make AIs that are essentially pea zombies.
You're jumping to conclusions here.
Yeah.
Because I am so sure I used to work with people that were basically zombies.
Yeah.
Like, there was no joy in their life. They were just going through the day to day.
So the deconstruction of that, which I think is compelling, is that you probably can't have a creature that does everything we do without experience, because there needs to, this gets very philosophical. We don't know the answer, but the speculations that I discuss in the book are, like, for example, we have to be able to attend to some things and not to other things, right? Something has to be paying attention. That has to be a phenomenon. Or we have to be able to distinguish what's happening right now from a memory. And it has to feel different in some way.
Or a good example is, if we didn't feel pain, we would probably engage in activities that caused an early demise.
Right.
And we might not procreate, and we wouldn't evolve.
The whole vertebrate nervous system is based on a system of reward and punishment, right, aversion. Mm-hmm. And that basically you could just extrapolate our entire brain from just a really, really sophisticated algorithm of reward and punishment. But something has got to feel attracted towards some behaviors and repulsed by others, right?
And how does that fit in with skeptics? Are there some people that are skeptical about the fact that other people experience things?
This is an argument for dualism, which is the notion that consciousness cannot be explained entirely by synapses firing in our brain. I strongly disagree with that position of dualism.
The idea that the mind and brain are separate entities that interact with one another.
Okay. And so are you of the mind that you need wet stuff to make a brain, as it were?
No.
No? Okay.
No, our mind is an emergent property of the firing of neurons in our brains.
Okay.
We are our brains. That's it. We are meat. That's it. And there's nothing else. There's no new phenomenon. There's no spirit. There's no magic. There's no life force. There's no dualism.
That's the monist perspective.
Yeah.
And so how does that work the other way around? Can our minds get us to cause us to do things? Do we have free will in that sense?
Yeah, that always comes to free will. I always dodge it. because it depends on how you define free will. So if you define it as, can you break the laws of physics? Can your mind operate somehow outside of the cause and effect of physics? No. But we have free will in that we do make decisions. We make choices. You know, and they're even... operationally, they're free choices, but yes, it is all the result of molecules banging around in our skulls, but it's indistinguishable from making choices. So do you count that as free will? I don't know. That's where you get philosophy.
But does mind stuff alter brain stuff in your world?
Well, in my view, there's just the brain.
Okay.
And the mind is just something the brain does.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fine.
Right.
And in terms of actual zombies, where do you sit on those?
On actual zombies?
Yes.
So the usual approach I take to them is, first, I plant a row of suns to provide the energy, right? Do you see where we're going with this? And then some kind of, like, pea shooter or...
Steve, that's plants versus zombies.
Is that what we're talking about?
I don't think so.
5 years too late for that joke? Is that what's happening?
More like eight.
Okay.
But we did discuss when we went to the Edinburgh Castle, that is a very defensible place against zombies.
Yeah. Yes. That's where you want to be.
Oh, yeah. That's why I said that great joke about it's never been invaded, which isn't a surprise. It's $12.95 to get in. And that all adds up if you've got an army. So,
don't they have group rates?
Sorry?
They have group rates?
That's right, yes, that's right. Okay, so that's where we stand on. Now, do you talk about zombies in the book? Actually, real zombies.
No.
Okay.
I fought for that, but he shot it down.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. It just didn't make the cut.
But we talk about ghosts. Oh, yeah. Do ghosts make it in?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think so. That's kind of like a zombie.
But why so anti-zombie?
I don't think I've found anybody who really thinks that zombies exist, right? Yeah. People think that ghosts exist.
The claim of zombies is not a major claim made by anyone.
Okay.
Or fantasy.
Yeah. Except for voodoo zombies.
Oh, that's real.
Yeah.
Well, that was Wade, isn't it? The Wade guy that went over and claimed that zombies were real and the result of voodoo-y, mixture-y chemical things.
Serpent and the Rainbow.
Serpent, that great guy. Yeah. I think he wrote Serpent and the Rainbow. Yeah. Somebody Wade. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Anyway.
Voodoo mixtury chemical things.
I haven't read it for a while. and I think the argument was more complicated than that. But it was you gave some people some voodoo stuff and that put them into a catatonic state. Yeah. And then they woke up under the ground, dug themselves out, and that's the origin of the zombie myth. I believe it's not true.
Yes.
Good. All right, okay. So we had page 42, another page number. 154, excellent. Okay, hold on a sec. Oh, okay, 154 is good. Colon hydrotherapy. Where do we all sit on that? I'm fine.
George, I believe you wrote an entire book about colonic
cleansing. Yeah.
Cleansing.
I did. I have a collection of essays called Spiritual Cleansing Through Colonic. What's it called? Colonic regularity, yes.
Oh, it's amazing that people actually, you know, sell colonic cleansing, which you could do with coffee. That's like the high-end stuff.
Yes.
Coffee enemas, you guys ever heard of coffee enemas? Is that a thing on this side of the pond?
No.
No? Good.
You know what blew my mind? Janet Jackson, remember this article? Yeah. Janet Jackson said that she's getting coffee enemas because the coffee will wash out the sad cells in her body. The sad cells in her body.
The hardest bit, though, is getting the sugar and cream up there, too.
It's worth it, though. It's worth it.
To say nothing of the stir.
Oh, I have a lot of friends who get colonics on a regular basis.
You need new friends, Kara. You need new friends.
This is an L.A. thing. People just do that there.
And what do you say to your friends when they do it? Are you skeptical, or do you let them get on with it?
No, of course I'm skeptical, but at a certain point, I mean, they know what I think. You know, it's pretty well aware.
They know
of what
that
I think.
You think.
They know that.
There's
I
a big
think.
Difference.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I guess if my friends were doing it, at some point you have to kind of accept it.
I know you're not gonna. I mean, if they know where I stand on this stuff, so at a certain point, what am I gonna not be friends with them?
Because that's the point.
They get colonics. They don't get coffee colonics. There are levels of it. Yeah. That's true. They go to there are spas in LA that do this, and it's a machine, and they lay on a bench, and you have to
safe.
Relax your muscles.
Yeah. It's not safe. Yeah. You shouldn't be. Stuff comes out of there. It doesn't go up.
I mean, some people.
What?
It's okay.
There have been perforations, infections. Absolutely. If there's a real actual risk involved.
Yep.
What's it actually involve? I'm so naive.
It's a tube.
Yeah.
And then
pressure. And what?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they say they feel.
And your
full.
Liquid of choice.
And what's the point of it?
It's to clean out the toxins.
It's meant to remove the heart, the whatever. They all have a percentage, right? Blah, blah percent is hardened fecal matter in your, and then it's got toxins and you are not.
It's
digesting.
A flushing. It's a flushing in essence. It's like the plumber coming in just high pressure jet through the old.
There are medical procedures where things are put up, aren't there?
Sure.
Yeah. A doctor doing it is okay.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And how
whoever's doing it in the mall in L.A. You know,
that's. So I did notice going through the book here on a very similar page. There's a one of the illustrations. You won't be able to see this, but it's a pair of buttocks.
Yes.
I'll just hold this up here, and you might be able to see it. It's a pair of buttocks. Is that what's going on there?
Those are bars.
That has nothing to do with colonic irrigation.
Okay. It's just an illustration you decided to include.
So that is, that's the butt reflexology, right? Oh, that's the homunculus. So that was...
Rump reading, right?
Yeah. No, this was a joke. This was a hoax. So these researchers submitted a paper to a conference, an international conference on alternative medicine, and they just invented a pseudoscience where it's butt reflexology. And that was the diagram from their paper. And they were happily accepted and were offered a spot to present their paper at the conference. And then they had to decline and say, no, we were just kidding.
Right. Okay.
Now that's not to be confused with Sylvester Stallone's mother who gives ass readings.
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah. Right. I don't say to that.
What's an ass reading?
She looks at your ass and tells your fortune.
Oh, it's fortune telling.
Yes.
It's fortune telling.
Right.
It's
phrenology, perhaps?
And
rumpology, yeah.
I said on an SGU episode about 10 years ago, hey, Ma, read my ass. Remember that? Yeah. That Sylvester Stallone. Yeah.
Wait, do you guys say ass or arse?
Arse. A-R-S-E, right? Yeah.
Sorry, arse reading. By the way, Carrie, did you get that hat here?
I did. I was cold, so I got this hat. I got you guys some. Would you like one?
Sure.
Yeah?
You got us hats?
I got special hats for all of you. Oh, Evans might have fallen on the floor. Here we go. This is for George.
Yeah, George gets the cool one, of course.
And Steve.
Oh, boy.
What do you guys think?
Hey. That's quite something. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good.
How do we look?
Good. You look cold. Yes, that's good.
Do we
that's
look
good.
Scottish?
You look, well, I wouldn't go that far, but yes.
I wanted to get a kilt. I wanted all of us to get kilts.
Right.
That was vetoed.
It was vetoed. Kara pointed out that they wouldn't be able to see them under the table. So I got a tie instead.
I like it.
Oh, yeah, very nice.
It's very nice. Apparently, this is from Clan Gunn. Clan Gunn?
Clan Gunn.
Yeah. Right. That's what it said on the little thing that was attached to it.
Right.
But help me out here. I'm a little concerned. So is this like gang colors? So like, if I go into the Clan MacLeod district, am I going to get shot with a longbow or something?
Yes, that's how it works, basically. Yeah. Yes. You're a brave man wearing it. That's all I'm saying.
Headed with a sword.
Well, I'm an expert on clans, so I can answer that. So basically, clans are small knitted creatures that whistle. And
write this down, Steve.
Yes, well, and so groups them together, and those as clangers. And I thought it was funny. And then they're visited by a giant iron chicken, which gives them soup. So that's basically how clans work. You didn't get British TV over there, did you?
I didn't see that one in BBC America.
So the clangers were my favourite things. They're little whistling knitted creatures.
What?
And they're not real creatures. They're just they're a sort of kids show put together by my goodness, what's the name of the guy who did?
Oliver Poshkate.
Thank you.
Are they like
Oliver
your biscuits?
Poshkate. Sorry.
Like your biscuits.
Like my biscuits, yes. That's right. It's getting very random. Yes, it's identical to my biscuits.
You have little knitted biscuits in your kitchen.
Oh, knitted biscuits. Yeah, I do have knitted biscuits. I forgot about the knitted biscuits. Yeah, they're like that. And they whistle instead of speak. And what's great is they got so bored during the recordings, they would swear. It's like a swanny whistle. They'd swear into the whistle. So if you know what they're actually saying, and the thing you can hear it, it's absolutely disgusting. So it's like the clangs, and you can actually hear it, it's actually saying, open the fucking door.
That's like South Park, in the first 5 seasons of South Park, when Kenny would sing during the opening theme. Mm-hmm. It was, I like girls with big fat titties, I like girls with big vaginas.
Right.
They took that out after the 5th season?
I think they changed it. I think he says something else, and I don't know what else he says from like 7 on.
Have you heard you guys had Sesame Street here, right?
We did, yes. Yeah.
Have you seen the YouTube video of the Count?
Oh,
and
yeah.
The overdub.
That is awesome.
They do it with Cookie Monster as well.
He says the word count every time. I like to count. Yes. 1, 2, 3. But it's, he's saying fuck every time. You should Google it. It's good. This is not a good podcast.
Right.
We'll just move on from here.
Yeah. So, it's getting back to the book for the moment, getting a bit more serious, and away from the clangers. I think this book comes at quite a timely time, which is a phrase I've just come up with. and one I won't be using again. I think the timing is that why do we need now, I think, more than ever, to be able to distinguish between reality and fake? What's happening in the world? There is a need for this, I think.
Where do you want to start? I mean, in the U.S., we said about a year ago, you're actually getting super hot. Right? That's a great hat to have for the winter, though. In the U.S., I mean, things have really taken a dramatic turn. And, you know, our country is divided politically in a way that I've never seen before in my life. And I don't think we've been in this situation for a very long time. So, you know, the book we were saying about a year ago when it was really starting to come together is, it's going to, I think, if people are interested in trying to see through the bullshit, you know, this will help navigate people through fake news. It'll help people turn, you know, some humility on themselves and their own ability to think and you know, even your memory. You know the whole deal about our memories. We can't trust our memories at all. And we have to also question our perception. And the book covers a lot of this stuff. You know, getting people, the right people to read it is the challenge because, you know, they don't want to read stuff like this because they like thinking the way that they do. But at least it'll help, people that are interested and see through fake news and things like that that are coming up in the media.
And is there a feeling, I mean, skeptics have been sort of going on about this for a very, very long time, the fact that people don't sort of think straight and make sort of terrible mistakes. Are we starting to see some of that now really mattering in a way that, I mean, you can argue that sort of ghosts and all that sort of stuff is kind of fun. As soon as it moves into politics, it all gets a little bit more serious. And at the minute, we're all seeing that being a little bit more serious. Is there a sense of that, do you think?
Yeah, I think the stakes are getting higher is the way it feels. Again, it's our perspective is always narrow. And, you know, some people will say that that was much worse in the past. And it probably was. I think if you just back up and take a longer view, I think we're probably better off now than we were 100 years ago and 200 years ago, et cetera. We're in a temporary maybe turn back, you know, and we'll get through it. But I do think that there's a lot of science denialism going around and that, and denying not only established science, like global warming, evolution, it's been around vaccines, you know, germ theory.
Around Earth.
HIV, I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of things. But there's also the denial of expertise, which is a sort of a deeper problem. It's not just this one specific issue, but those scientists don't know what they're talking about. And anyone who has any claim to knowledge is just an elitist, you know, just trying to downgrade any claim that you have any expertise, which is just a way of saying, I can just dismiss anything I don't want to believe because those experts don't know what they're talking about. You know, so
that's what the term fake news has become. I'm just going to dismiss anything I don't agree with.
It's
as fake
news.
And what do we do about that? I mean, you could ask people to read the book or listen to the podcast, but in terms of particularly younger minds who are going to be growing up in that culture rather than the one which we've grown up in, which is I think far more respectful towards science. What do you do about that? How can you start to turn the tide?
You vote for the candidate that is going to be the best candidate who is going to defend science, intellectualism, rationality, and all these other things. And you cannot vote for the people who absolutely deny these things.
You know, also popularizing science or people that believe in science, like, you know, Sheldon from Big Bang Theory. It's weird to think that that character is making people become scientists, but it's happening.
Mm. Okay.
I was just wondering if there's a technological side to this in terms of, when you go on Facebook, or if you're on Wikipedia, or certain kinds of servers, if you want to see boobs on Facebook, you pretty much can't, because it is a self-correcting, self-governing system that's there that removes sexual content, that removes certain kinds of abusive content. Why isn't there some kind of an algorithm that can determine the veracity of content? Why isn't that being pushed in terms of, can we develop technological constraints at least within so that the stuff that's being broadcast has some level of genuineness and truth into it?
Well, there are. There are plenty of people working on that. The problem is who is the person who decides that? And at what point
are you... Steve, he could do it.
You know, in the U.S., this runs up against some First Amendment issues about speech and protected speech.
I mean, private companies like a Facebook.
That's not a First Amendment issue.
It has become one. There has been quite the argument that Facebook is actually...
If you count it as a utility.
Exactly. Yeah. It's tricky. Issue.
Yeah. I had an idea, which was that you'd monitor, say, I don't know, 5,000 people. You'd know their IQs, and you'd monitor what TV they're watching. And whenever you were watching TV in the corner, there'd be an average of the IQ of the people who were watching that show.
Ooh, shame.
Yes.
It's like a shame game.
So you go, it's a great show. My goodness, look, there's a bunch of idiots watching it, and you turn over. So probably not going to catch on. But anyway, yes.
That would require insight.
Yes, yes, and yes, and honesty on some IQ tests as well. But yes,
I do think, yeah, the world has changed, right? So there's no longer any editorial filter in place. It's the Wild West, you know, the internet, which is good and bad. And the good thing is we have access to a lot of information. The bad thing is we have access to a lot of misinformation, and there's really no filters there. I don't know that I really want to trust Mark Zuckerberg to be that much in control of what's fake news and what's not fake news. I mean, yes, there has to be some standards, but like, you know, absolute fraud and things like that, but I don't want anyone policing political opinions. We just need an educated populace who can distinguish these things for themselves. There's no substitute for that. You know what I mean?
Steve, we talked recently about Wikipedia and how Wikipedia has improved over the many years that we've been using it and accessing it. It's become a crowdsourcing effort in which experts do go on there and make sure that they're able to contain and minimize bad information that does appear, it used to appear, on Wikipedia. They've done a much better job along those lines, and maybe that's the kind of model we can start looking at.
Something that's essentially comes down to quality control, you know, but not deciding what's real and what's fake in a way. But it is very tricky. It's hard. There's no clean answer.
But there were such insane claims being made by certain people that are easily proven to be incorrect.
Yeah, that's true.
There's got to be a baseline to say you can't publish that as a fact. Really, you cannot, yeah. In the same way that a person selling you a car can't lie, oh, this car can fly. Hey, it's my opinion, this car can fly. But, you know, buy the car. It's a, you know, there's a yeah. level of...
Right, people don't have the right to fraud in their free speech. That is not a right.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, something happened recently where InfoWars was pretty much getting pushed off the internet.
Right.
And I was just saying, oh, man, let this be a trend. I was just hoping it was going to snowball. But we could start with that. I mean, we have people that are putting out content that is literally manufactured the day before it gets aired. They shouldn't be allowed to be on the internet. Let's just keep going with that. But how do we do it?
InfoWars, are you aware of InfoWars?
No. Alex Jones.
Yeah. It's a conspiracy site. It's actually that he just sell Alex Jones, yeah. He sells snake oil, and he gets his audience and sells snake oil by just pandering to the worst conspiracy theories possible.
But like he actually does.
Yeah.
Like basically everything he does is in service to these commercials about doomsday prepper gold. And
vitamins
and like weird things to store in your basement for the apocalypse.
And related to that, here's a tricky question. If I don't know, big broadcaster said, look, you know, you can tell the whole of the country, the whole of the world, one thing from this book. You can let everyone know just one thing. What bit would you like everyone to know?
That's tricky because critical thinking isn't one thing. Yeah. It's like it's a set of skills.
But if you were given
just
yes, but
how about self-deception? That's a key
maybe.
Thing,
yeah, I think probably if I had to pick one chapter, you can't. But if I had to, I would probably say confirmation bias.
Oh yeah.
Because maybe from there they will branch out. Because it is, you know, confirmation bias is like the master bias of all.
Yeah, that's
biases.
A great idea, Steve. That's a great idea. Yeah. That's really good. I like that a lot. That's a really good
idea. I hadn't read about it, and then I read about it, and I saw mentions of it everywhere. So it's amazing. So that was funny, Alan. So shows. I think Michael John Ronson's joke as well.
I think that's the quote at the top of the chapter.
Was it? I'm so sorry. Talk about confirmation bias then. Why is it that so important?
So confirmation bias is essentially operating in the background unconsciously. It's essentially your brain sifting all of the massive amount of information out there, looking for patterns, filtering out what doesn't fit, what doesn't confirm what you want to believe or what you already believe. It accepts does confirm what you already believe. And then it builds this really powerful illusion that the evidence supports your belief. But it's really the belief that created the perception of the evidence. It goes the other way around. But it's so self-reinforcing. That's why people like are so sure. A lot of prejudice comes from this, right? Oh, yeah, I know, like, all Scots are this way, right? Because every time somebody does that, they're Scot. But that's confirmation bias because you don't notice it when they don't do it, or you don't notice it when things break the rules, you're not looking for it, you don't notice it, or you dismiss it, or that's the exception, which is just a way of dismissing data. But whenever it does seem to fit your belief, that's a keeper, right? That's something you remember and reinforce and probably exaggerate over time in your memory. So you're building up this repertoire of fake information or real information that's just been curated, not at random, but deliberately to reinforce beliefs. And so it just creates this powerful illusion that you're correct when you may not be.
So whenever I've seen anyone eat a deep fried haggis, they go, Jesus. I think that's because it's shite. Is that confirmation bias? And I'm just forgetting all the times people go, that was really nice. Or is it just shite?
Yeah, it could be. No, exactly. That's a good example. Though, because
could be a religious experience, and that's why they're saying Jesus.
Yeah. It could be, yes. Well, if it involves projectile vomiting as well. So, I'm right about deep fried haggis, aren't I? It's horrible, isn't it? It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. Yes. I don't know. It's a bit of a split on it. We'll do an evidential one. I don't even do evidence. We'll do evidence. Hands up if you think deep fried haggis is disgusting. Okay, hands down. Hands up if you think it's all right. Unbelievable. It shows my confirmation bias.
No, right.
It shows my... Because I thought everyone thought it was shite.
We tried it.
You tried, okay.
Well, it wasn't deep fried.
It wasn't deep fried.
It was haggis. It wasn't deep fried.
Well, mine was in a pastry, so it was kind of deep fried.
Yeah, okay.
No, actually... You know, it turns out that, you know, basically it's a kind of meat, the mixture of these different kinds of meat. And if it's spiced right, if it's cooked right, it didn't taste bad at all, actually. I was shocked. You guys know, like in America, like haggis is a joke. It's like, you know, like your whole cuisine is based off of a dare, like type of stuff. So I had this thing built up in my head that they were going to bring out like a bloody stomach filled with lungs and livers.
Essentially, they did actually. Yeah.
I know that you hear the traditional stuff. That's the way they do it, but there's no blood, right? It actually, even if they do cook it and it comes out like a whole, lung comes spilling out of the stomach, yes. Supposedly it still tastes good.
I don't think it's lung. I think it's just the other organ.
It's liver. It's anything. It's anything. Yes.
Kidney, liver, and lung.
Yes. It's anything anything you wouldn't want to eat on its own is in there, basically. So, yes.
It's like a hot dog. It's an American hot dog.
Yes. Very similar. Pretty much. Very similar, yep. Yes.
Except no rats.
Yes. Yeah.
In the U.S., we say lips and assholes. That's what you're eating when you eat hot dogs.
We do?
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
You never heard that with hot dogs?
It must be on the East Coast.
Yeah, it's a Connecticutian.
Good one. Glad we've got that all sorted out. I think that's
anyone hungry?
good. Okay. So what we're going to do, I think, is have a little break. The book is available. It's a fantastic book. And it's going to be available, and I think you guys are going to sign afterwards rather than anything.
Yep.
So when the bar's open. But to play us out, and then I will thank you all properly for the first half, then we have George, and then we'll do Q&A in the second half.
Yeah.
But George, you want to give us a play-out song?
My grandpa would sit me right on his knee and tell me about how things used to be. A simpler time of simpler ways. Through tears he'd tell me about the good old days. The good old days, yeah, the good old days were a special time of such note. Before all these computers and cellular phones, before any woman could vote. The good old days, yeah, the good old days, when a child could work in a mine. Their hands were the right size for gathering coal, and you barely had to pay for their time. The good old days, yeah, the good old days, when doctor essentially meant pain. They could kill you with unwashed and infected hands. Good thing soft drinks were filled with cocaine. The good old days, yeah, the good old days. A spittoon in every bar by your feet. And while spitting indoors was a luxury, at least horses could shit in the streets. Saying please and thank you through World Wars I and II. A great time to be around, unless, of course, you had skin that was brown. The good old days, yeah, the good old days. Its legacy just never ends. Unlike most of the kids in your neighborhood, after polio killed all your friends. Good old days, yeah, the good old days, when a gentleman always wore a tie. And if you heard about someone being online, that meant guys in white hoods were nearby. Family meals Sunday nights, while many had no civil rights. Leading such devout lives, while husbands could legally rape their wives.
Ouch.
The good old days, yeah, the good old days. Is a phrase we should be done with. Now I know why Grandpa would tear up when he spoke. He knew the good old days are a myth.
SDU, Sean Carroll, 15 minutes back here. Thanks a lot.
And what we're going to do is this Q&A. So if you have any questions, that's going to be very helpful. Gentlemen there, you were very fast, so there we go.
I'm not a reader myself, but I've heard a fair amount of criticism of the American Skeptic magazine. Do you guys have any thoughts about that?
Okay, so the question was about the American Skeptic magazine, which is Michael Shubb's magazine.
The Skeptic magazine.
Which one? Skeptic, magazine. Not Skeptical Inquirer. We have two.
Yes. So one's coming out of the Center for Inquiry, which is Skeptical Inquirer. The other is Michael Shermer's Skeptic magazine. The question was, there's been some criticism of it. What do you think? Very happy for you to cover that topic.
Yeah, I mean, the criticism that I've heard is that there's a little bit of a libertarian slant to Skeptic magazine. And people think that... there's a we. And that, you know, we shouldn't have a political bias in the Skeptical movement. We should be nonpartisan. But it's hard to completely filter out your ideology because of, you know, things like confirmation bias. And so, you know, this is probably the single most disappointing thing to me personally about the Skeptical movement is that, I mean, if there's one group of people in the world that can rise above ideology and partisanship, it should be skeptics, right? But no. Seriously, we had this sort of brief honeymoon period after the internet turned on, you know, and everyone was like, oh, there's other skeptics in the world, yay! And then it didn't take long for people to retreat to their ideological corners. Yeah. And so that's where all this is coming from.
Yeah, but not just on the right, but on the left as well.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Thank you. Okay, so the question is about World Health Organization, the fact they're going to recognize Chinese medicine, apparently. Any thoughts on that?
I might have an opinion or two about it. I did write an article about it for Science-Based Medicine, where I go into excruciating detail.
We talked about it on the show,
I think we did. Yeah, we might have. But briefly, so they're recognizing it as part of their coding system, and they say, this is just so we could track it. It's like... yeah, maybe you might think that, but no. That's not, first of all, we know it's not just so you can track it. I mean, the person who is promoting this at the head of the World Health Organization is Chinese and is trying to promote Chinese culture and Chinese medicine. So, sorry, no. But also, it also legitimizes it. It absolutely legitimizes it. And so it's either deceptive or naive or both. It's somewhere along that spectrum. But, you know, the practices, the other thing is, let's talk about a con job, right? The traditional Chinese medicine has branded itself to the West deliberately, you know, for medical tourism and, again, sort of cultural hegemony, et cetera, has branded itself as this sort of all-natural, gentle, you know, method of treating based on ancient Chinese wisdom, which is like a cliche. But that's not what it is. It's actually a set of brutal methods that are unsafe, are completely fantasy-based, and it's nothing natural about it. They're manipulating magical energy, which doesn't exist. They're hunting down endangered species so that they could use their, you know, grind their bones or take their bodily fluids and sell them as magical potions. It really is a brutal form of healthcare with a slight modern patina on it, which was actually deliberately manufactured, you know, by the Chinese government to sell it, you know. It's actually nothing that's happening today has been going on for a couple thousand years, which is actually, in a way, a good thing because it was a far worse in the past, but it was just a very fairly recent reinvention for branding, you know, but it's still 100% nonsense.
How
it has no place in the World Health Organization.
How recent? Like the 60s, the 40s?
Well, no, yeah, the 30s, 40s. Yeah, it's like it's not even 100 years old, what is passing for traditional Chinese medicine today.
Okay, very clear answer. Some other questions. There's some other folks in the room. See some hands up. Okay, so gentlemen out there, shout as loud as you can. Okay, so the question is about Perry, who unfortunately passed a few years ago. And the question is saying that Perry was a climate change denier, and the question is, would you think he'd have changed his mind by now?
We were talking about this, just the other
couple days ago.
Literally just talking that exact question.
Well, it started with, we were like, oh my, what would Perry think about where we're at now? What would Perry have thought of the book? What would Perry have thought of us, you know, going to Scotland? Would, you know, all those things. And then it somehow came up, you know, we were talking about him being a climate denier and how he was just about tipping over.
Well, it's more complicated than that. He wasn't like a full-on denier. He was Perry was team Republican, but he definitely didn't agree with everything in the platform. He was socially progressive, you know, just like we all are. So he was okay saying, yeah, I don't. He obviously was not religious, so he disagreed with anything that was religious right, anything that was regressive. You know, he was total freedom. But then there were some things where he would held on to sort of that position just because that was his team. He was very tribal in that way. But I was able, like in individual cases, able to get him to acknowledge the science whenever it was there, but then he would cling to any bit of science that he, confirmation bias, his way to try to protect that. So I like to think that, you know, 10 years, 11 years later, we would have worn him down. But we'll never know. We'll just never know, like how tightly he would have clung.
I don't think he would have held on all with everything that's going on today.
I'd like to think that, but I have to admit that we just don't know.
Remember, Penn and Teller used to question whether climate change was kind of real. They were very much on the fence, if not teetering the other direction. But they finally, after many years, did come around and said and accepted yes. And I sort of think Perry was probably on that same trajectory. Yeah.
And Shermer admitted to that too. And again, these are all people who are on the right side of the political spectrum, which again gets back to the fact that your views on global warming could be 100% predicted by your political affiliation.
Yeah. But we saw the same thing on the left with Bill Nye, who I don't know how well known he is here. You know of him, that's good. And I mean, he had the same kind of mind change with genetically modified organisms. He, you know, I think he stuck to party lines until he saw the evidence.
Yeah.
And then he changed his mind quite publicly. Yeah, that's a cool thing to see.
He's done that more than once. Yeah.
Great example of that happening. I think the skeptical movement in general, you bring up GMOs. How many people here think that GMOs are great? Good. How many people think that, you know, you should be cautious, new technology, maybe they're unsafe? A couple of people. You know, even if you...
It's interesting, that was the same people who like deep-fried haggis. That can't be chance.
Is fried haggis organic? I think a few years ago, you know, even in the skeptical movement, there were a lot of people who were questioning, GMO questioning, we'll call it. They weren't necessarily GMO deniers or anti-GMO. And that's... We've changed that deliberately because... of, you know, activists in the movement saying, nope, this is an issue. We have to be in line with the science, just like global warming, just like vaccines, just like anything. And so that took time, but we turned that ship around at least within our own movement, and now we're trying to do it the same thing to the general population. It's a much slower, it's a much bigger barge to turn around, but, you know, I do think that that's a good example of that. But again, it was totally along party lines initially, but then eventually the science won out, right?
Okay. Okay, another question. There was a gentleman there. Okay, so question about, a very good question about social media and confirmation bias. So the impact of social media on skepticism.
Well, that's a complicated question. In the beginning, I think with any groups that pre-existed the internet, it made finding other skeptics much easier. You know, all of these groups came about. Then you started to see blogs and podcasts come out, and all of that was great. And as we refer to the honeymoon phase that all these, you know, groups experience. But, you know, I think you're asking because you're thinking that there's a potential negative. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time on Facebook for the SGU. And Facebook, we all learned, it ended up being, you know, basically a circle jerk. Like, you only got to see news items or things that you would appreciate.
What's a circle jerk?
So.
Because I've never heard that phrase.
We're not going to answer that question. It's a Google question.
I'm going to put it into Google now. See what happens.
It's exactly what you said.
Don't scream when
you're Don't do image search, though.
Really?
I have a laptop right here.
Circle jerk. All right, okay. And I'm actually reading out. Oh, okay. See, that's only done at independent schools in our kind of, so a group of males stand in a circle to jerk off onto a cookie or anything of the sort.
You call them biscuits, though.
A group of biscuits stand in a circle. But I've never been asked to take part in that sort of thing.
I'm not surprised.
No.
What are you doing later?
No, I'm not standing in a circle.
Okay, so the answer is...
Why was I even thinking? For a minute I was thinking, well, would I? No, of course I wouldn't.
It can be a square. My answer is that we are just as susceptible to the BS on social media and, you know, the fact that you are fed things that they think you want to see as anybody else. And a cool thing to do, as an example, if you want to like just peek right behind the mirror, go start a brand new account and don't put your real name into it. And just see what you get and check it out. Like friend a few people that you know and just dance around. And I did this. And I was comparing news. I first did it because I just wanted to see if the ads that I was putting up, you know, I pay Facebook to show new people our podcast. And I just was doing some research. I'm like, hey, I never see news items like this. And then I started to dig deeper, and it's a different world depending on who you're logged in as. And if you're a non-skeptic versus a skeptic, you would be shocked at what the differences are. I mean, they know everything that we do, guys. Seriously. All of the social media outlets know everything that we do. Google knows where we go. Google knows what we search for online. Google knows that when you open up that thing that everybody thinks, the incognito window...
That's slightly unfortunate.
It's not safe. Yeah. Incognito window, all it does is not write information to your computer about where you went. Google still records where you're looking, so be careful.
Jay, Google doesn't know anything about what we're doing in Scotland because I can't get online. That's the problem.
So, but the idea must be who's first?
Yes.
Surely... It's not a race, is it? I mean, normally.
The real problem is if there's one or two lefties in the mix, the whole thing doesn't work.
There's the voice of experience. But in real life, it's not a race, is it?
In real life, only like weird college boys do this.
I think it's like cannibalism where no one actually does it, but everyone thinks somebody else does it. You know what I mean? I don't personally know anyone who's ever... Everyone's like has that look on their face. Yeah. And no one's ever actually done it, but they think it's
a thing. Some of the people out there look like this right now.
I've done it. I've been a cannibal.
Has anyone here ever actually done it?
They're not going to admit to that.
Come on. This is a scientific experiment.
Hands up.
Raise your hand.
Yeah, hands up. Hands down. Hands up. Hands down. No, that's right. Okay. Right, well, this is a good time to interrupt questions for anyone on the podcast. You have science or fiction. Mm-hmm. And today, Sean has prepared, I think, a Scottish-based version of that. So, Sean, I'm going to invite you over here and to play science or fiction with us. So, away you go.
It's time for science or fiction.
Sean,
everyone, round for Sean. Yay! So hopefully you guys can play along, but that's all right. So question number one to everybody. You ready? So Dolly the Sheep, you all know Dolly the Sheep, very famous, created in the Rosalind Institute here in Edinburgh, the very first cloned mammal, famously had no father, but she actually had three mothers. Yeah, that's fact number one. Fact number two. Morag, the Morag mermaid monster, is said to live in the wild and remote Loch Morag on the west of Scotland. You all know the Loch Ness monster. This is the alternative. Okay, and the third fact. We all know that Scots invented the modern world. We invented everything. Did you know that St. Magnus of Iona in the 850s invented the chair? Before that, people used Roman lounges, stools, chests, that sort of thing. But St. Magnus attached the back and arms to a stool, as documented in the ancient Brook of Crinan. So there's the three facts. Do we have Dublin the sheep had three mothers? Do we have Morag the Morar mermaid monster? Or St. Magnus of Iona inventing the chair?
Hi, this is Steve breaking in. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as we did recording it. So the audio quality there on the science or fiction questions are a bit dodgy, so I thought I would just say what they are cleanly so to make sure that you heard them. Item number one is that the clone sheep Dolly had three mothers. Item number two is that Scotland has a less well-known myth of Morag of Loch Morar, which is a mermaid monster. And item number three is that St. Magnus of Iona invented the chair. Okay, enjoy science or fiction.
Shall we ask the audience first?
Sure.
Right, so one of these three is fiction, two are fact. By the way, Morag the Mermaid Monster, I don't think she actually exists, but the legend of it exists. Okay? So if you think number one is a fiction, can we have a single clap? Now, you think number two is a fiction, can we have a single clap now? And number three is a fiction, single clap now. I think number three on the brands. So, do you guys want to go through it? Start off with George.
My goodness, yeah. If we're going to go by the audience, I would say number three is probably the fiction. But I think there's a trick in number two, the Morag, the Morar mermaid monster. What was the name of the horsey?
Kelpies.
We saw the Kelpie statues the other day, and I think there's some variation of Kelpie falsity there. So I'm going to say that number two, the Morag, the Morar mermaid monster, is the fiction. I can't not say it that way. My gosh, Robert.
All right, I'm kind of pissed at myself that I don't know number one about Dolly definitively. I guess it's possible they could have had three mothers, but I'm not sure about that one. The third one, yeah, that makes sense. Nothing there is ringing any bells. The second one doesn't make as much sense as the other one. So how does a mermaid live in the wild? It kind of just drag itself along through the woods?
No, in the
wild and remote. Oh, the lock is remote and wild. Gotcha. I'll take another tack, then I think I'll have to metagame this. The Dolly and the Magnus is something that I think you'd be proud of. So you wouldn't want them to be fiction. So I'll go with the second one. Morag the Mermaid Monster is fiction.
Yeah, these are interesting. So, like, I know it's possible to have three mothers, you know, two sets of DNA and one mitochondrial. That's usually how you do that. I don't know for a fact if Dolly had that or not, though. So, that's plausible, but I don't know for sure that that's true. Now, the one that's bothering the most is the third one about the chair, just because we never know who really invented things like that long ago. It's, like, too obvious an invention, and it does seem a little recent. It's possible that there's a belief that, you know, St. Magnus of Iona invented the chair, but I would want to really investigate that before I would buy it. And I've never heard of two. It could be true. It could be not true. I don't really know what to base that on. So I'm going to go with the audience actually and say that the chair is the fiction.
I'm really confused about the Dolly the sheep one because I don't know how you're defining mother. So she's a clone, which means that she is cloned. So she is the DNA of whomever she was cloned from. So she wouldn't have a mother or a father. She would have a clone mom.
Twin.
Yeah, she would have a twin mother. And also, does that mean she would have a mother who she was birthed from? Because you need a womb, but you can't be birthed from three different sheep. So was she raised by three different sheep? I don't know. I do not understand this three mothers. Unless maybe they took DNA from three different female sheep and like mixed it together in the hopes that at least Yeah, that one of them would have become the clone. But then she wouldn't technically have three mothers. She would have had three potential mothers, but only one mother. So this one, the wording of this one is messing with me. And so I'm going to say it's the fiction.
See, all I care about is with this first one, my takeaway is that whoever Dolly's father sheep was, he got to have sex with three mothers.
That's not how cloning works.
Don't interrupt me. Because I spent the whole day with Sean, and I know how this guy's mind works now. I mean, I like what Steve said about, you know, you never really know who created this or invented that. But I don't know, something about that, I may have read something, there's something banging around in my head about that. And this thing with Morag, the Morar mermaid monster, I'll put money on the table that you just made up that word Morag. As a matter of fact, wait a second, if I think about this, that's a D&D monster. So I think number two is the fiction.
Oh, it's me, right?
Yes.
Good job with this, by the way, Sean.
Yeah,
Dolly. So, didn't have a father, so no circle jerk there.
Although if there was, they'd all do it together, because sheep just copy one another, don't they? So, one would start, and everyone would join in.
They did, but they have hooves.
Wow, you learned a lot.
You can masturbate with hooves.
Sure you can.
You can. You can masturbate with hooves. Some of my friends. It's a niche fetish. But
is that a Doctor Who fan?
No, it's
very good.
It's called panspermia.
Anyway, sorry, I was interrupting you. Sorry.
Jay brings up a good point about Morag and Dungeons and Dragons, I think. That's not a bad point. But what am I going to do? Am I going to go against this native audience on their guess about the third one, which clearly most of them believe that one's the fiction? And what Steve said sounds right as far as that goes. I mean, who invented the chair? How do you really know? Probably some Chinese philosopher 5,000 years ago invented the chair. Who really knows? That one, I think, is the fiction.
Okay.
As well, Richard?
I think they're all fiction. So I don't think Dolly the Sheep exists. Morag isn't a Scottish name, so I don't know what's happening there. And I don't think anyone invented the chair. I haven't got one. So I think they're all fiction.
Can I say
you're wrong, Richard?
Right, okay, I'm wrong. Yes, very good.
I did figure out the Dolly thing. I was thinking about it, and it's one mother is the DNA, one mother's the egg, and one mother's a womb. She had to have three mothers.
Right. Yeah. So you got the DNA, the egg, and the kind of the embryo.
Yeah.
She has a real Dolly mixture.
Sorry.
And who raised Dolly? Why does she get no credit?
You can't visit her. She's in the National Museum of Scotland. You can see her.
All right.
She had four mothers.
She had four mothers, so it's fiction.
Cut him some slack, guys. This is his first science or fiction, okay?
Cut me some slack. I'm trying to win here.
Sean, you're doing great, man. Keep going.
Thank you. I'm embarrassed now. But anyway, so the first one we know is science. The second one, Morag the Mermaid Monster, is in fact science.
Oh! Hey.
There are sightings of Morag, which is about 70 miles from Loch Ness, is Loch Morag. And from about 1887, there have been various sightings. Some have seen a 20-foot-long creature in the loch. In 1969, two men claimed to have accidentally hit the creature in their boat. Morag is said to have disappeared after one of the men hit it with an oar. And his companion opened fire with a rifle. And of course, the last one is completely fictitious. There's a Scottish comedian who basically claims that the Scots invented chairs. If you want to believe that, you're fine, but no, there's been chairs for a long time.
Very good.
Very good.
Okay,
yeah.
Round of applause for Sean.
Very good.
Thank you all.
Actually, I went to a talk about the Loch Ness Monster. Mm-hmm. There was a man who had a theory that it only came out at night, and he'd gone up to Loch Ness and taken photos. But it was so dark, we couldn't see anything at all in the photos. And someone in the audience said, why don't you go up when there's a full moon, because there'd be enough light to see. And he said, oh, don't be stupid, that's when the werewolves come out. Anyway, any other questions? Some other questions for our guests here. So don't be shy, hands up, anyone want a question? Yes, person there. That's a very good question. Excellent. The question was, for those who didn't catch it, you're very well read, apparently. And how do you structure your day, because you have jobs, in order to, A, produce a book that's 500 pages long, and also podcast and all the stuff you do?
I'm a big fan of audiobooks. I had, when cassettes were a thing, I remember I had over 200 books on cassette. And so I would listen during my commute. Now it's all digital, all on my phone. I've Audible.com account, so I just listen. That's 2 hours a day of listening to whatever books that I want to listen to. So that's a great productive use of my time, I think.
Okay. What else?
Yeah, with me, it's just scheduling, you know, because I'm very busy, but...
You're a proper doctor.
Yes, I'm an actual physician. That's right.
Right.
That's my day job.
Right. Yeah. So you've got a proper day job, yeah, and you do all this stuff as well.
Yes. Right.
Amazing.
But Steve doesn't sleep.
Yeah, he does.
He doesn't sleep as much as most people.
I don't sleep enough.
See, but he also manages to keep up to date on television shows and series. Yeah. And
gotta have downtime. But it's all scheduled. Like, I have like times a day where this is when I'm doing my writing. This is when I, you know, whatever. So that, for me, I don't think this necessarily works for everybody. You gotta find what works for you. For me, just if I have, usually it's like I have to get through my work, and then when I'm done, then I can watch TV shows with my wife or whatever. That's
because what I've had to do is cut out a lot of TV watching. I am not up to date on a lot of the TV shows. These guys talk about things like, you know, Black Mirror and Stranger Things and other things. I haven't seen Game of Thrones. I've never seen an episode. I just don't. Because something had to give in order to be able to kind of do what I do. So that's what I chose to give up.
You got to make time for Game of Thrones. Come on.
Yeah. No, I don't want to have you guys.
Everyone's right, though. I mean, you know, we've been doing this now for 13 years. Carrie, you've been with us for 4 years, right? I mean, it's sacrifice. We have to give up other stuff. I mean, I take a break in the middle of the show. You know, we stop recording, and I run downstairs. I'll grab a glass of water. I see my wife sitting on the couch. And every time I'm like, Liz comes over, and these guys watch TV. And every time I go down there, you know, I get sad. I really, you know, I'm like, I don't want to go back up. I want to hang out with my wife, you know, but I also want to do the show. It's one of the most important things of my life. And you know what? Like, I read a lot of science news, and unfortunately, like, it eats up a lot of my, like, I can sit here and just read a book time. You know, I wish I had more time to do, and I like to read books. I don't like to listen to books. Like, I'll listen to a book by someone who's super entertaining. But if I'm just going to, you know, if I want to read a science book or whatever, I want to read it. I don't want to, like, look at something electronic. So yeah, there's sacrifice, but I mean, you know, it's a great sacrifice because we get to do this and we love being with each other and hanging out, and you just something's got to give, like Evan said.
Yeah, I never get to read for pleasure anymore. I mean, except when I'm off semester. So I went back to school last year to finally finish my PhD. So I'm, you know, working on two podcasts. I work on a television show. I have other things, you know, I get booked to give talks and things like that. I'm traveling with these guys, but I'm also a full-time PhD student right now. So like today, they were all walking around and they went to the castle.
They
went to the illusion.
Yeah, the illusion tower.
The pinhole
camera. Yeah, that was cool.
I didn't get to do any of that. I was back in my hotel room, like working on a, you know.
But that's the way it's been, though. Yeah. I mean, like anytime we're at an event, you're like, all right, where are you guys going to be? When are we having dinner? Okay, I'll meet you there at 5.
I know, it's tough because they're like, we'll figure it out later. I'm like, no, I got to know now. Yeah. I got to go back and try and write one more paper. But that's, you know, that's part of the game. I'm definitely always logging in at like midnight or 1 a.m. local time to meet up, you know, for my school meetings and things like that, because it's the middle of the day there.
There are lots of times you can find to read that might be unexpected in terms of, I know it might sound too personal, but I read a lot on the toilet.
I think you need to get that checked out.
No. I will literally read until my legs fall asleep. But there's also, like, when you go to a movie and you're waiting for the movie to start, I'll sit and I'll read a book. If I'm having lunch on my own, I'll sit and I'll read during lunch. So you find these sort of places as opposed to doing this. When you're waiting in line for a bus or you're waiting in line for something, you have a book. And it's like if you can get 6-7 minutes at a shot throughout the day 4 or 5 times, all of a sudden you have a half hour of reading. Mm-hmm. And it can add up nice and quick. And it feels awkward at first to be in a crowd full of people doing this and you're doing this, you know. And it feels strange, but you know what? Because you're reading. So it's...
George, and all the people on their phones, if they happen to notice her reading the book, like, what's wrong with her?
Seriously, yeah. No, you get looks. Like in a movie theater, if you see a person reading in a movie theater, you get looks. But it's like, I got 15 minutes. I'm not going to watch the ads. I'm going to read this book.
You know what I find funny that kind of reminds me? Like, this happens all the time. We're doing a show, and I look, and there's a woman knitting in the audience. And the first time I saw it, I'm like, the hell are you doing? And then I'm like, that's genius. Because knitting is kind of unconscious, right? You know, any of that stuff, just doing it. And I find that I talk to people that do it, and they say it's relaxing.
Yeah,
I want to knit.
And if you're going to make something, you've got to do it all the time.
Reading books right now, too, which is kind of perfect. So, yeah,
okay, very good. Any other questions? Yes, person there. Okay, so the question is whether mistrust in science is due to scientific imperialism.
I think so. I think that's a big problem. I think science has historically been done by white men. And it's been done by white men in the Western world. And so I think that we've got to see changes within our scientific institutions. But I don't think that's the only reason that people distrust science, because a lot of white men distrust science, especially in our country. So I think science represents, yes, imperialism to a lot of people, but science also represents authority to people who are conspiracy theorists. And they don't want to trust those authority figures. I think for people with certain political persuasions, science represents dogma, because they don't really understand that science is a method and not just a collection of thoughts and ideas. And a lot of people right now are rejecting the elitist, quote-unquote, scientists. They're rejecting the whole concept of advanced education, because they think it represents... a type of control, a type of social control, which is, I think, quite problematic.
Yeah, I do. I think that the scientists and the institutions need to do an order of magnitude more outreach than they're currently doing. It really is kind of an afterthought. Like, if you want to do it, okay, that's good for you. That's nice. It's like it doesn't really count academically as much as it should, at least in the U.S. I think maybe it does more over here. Right, Richard, you are actually a professor of the public understanding of psychology.
Yeah, yes, so
that doesn't exist in the U.S., so, as far as I know. I mean, that kind of title. I think that's great. But that universities, again, it doesn't matter what they say. The only thing that matters is what they do, right? Like where they put their money where their mouth is. And you just don't get any academic credit for popularizing science.
Well, some people are actively discouraged from doing it. You know, they're told not to self-promote. Yep.
To self-promote, because that's how it's seen.
That's how they see it.
There's still a bit of a taint, but I think there needs to be massive outreach from working scientists. And also, they need to learn. Richard and I were talking about this over lunch. They need to learn more about popular beliefs in pseudoscience, et cetera, because they really don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And because of that, it actually impedes their ability to communicate to the public. And, you know, what I hear, like, from those of us who are doing, I get either, like, why are you bothering with the kooks, or, oh, I'm glad you're doing it, so I don't have to worry about it, you know. But not, like, yes, this is something institutionally that we need to do. And I think, hopefully, you know, we talk also about, yes, there's a lot of bad stuff happening right now. There's a lot of good stuff happening right now, too. But is the backlash going to be better than the pain that we're going through right now? We don't know. We'll know, you know, in 10 or 20 years, but I hope so. And one of the backlashes that could be helpful are, I think, the institutions of science waking up and realizing that they can't be toiling away in their ivory tower while the internet, you know, destroys our world, that they have to engage. If we're not engaged, we're going to get factored out of the equation.
Steve, do you think it's also deliberate marketing to discredit science?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that was my number
we
one answer.
We talked about this recently on the show, too, that it's used. They know that they can use the imperial card or the colonialism card or whatever to dismiss that it was Western scientists or whatever. And that, it just becomes another way to deny science.
But if science supports their belief, they tell the world.
But I also think that we have to be careful not to completely minimize that line of thought and say, oh, that's pseudoscience, that's just pseudoscience in sheep's clothing, because I think there's a lot of legitimacy to that argument that if we just, you know, dismiss it in whole cloth, that's going to be problematic as well.
Yep. Okay, thank you. My goodness. Okay, we'll take a gentleman here. Sorry, the check shirt, and then we'll come to a person
around.
Here. Yes. Okay, so skepticism in young kids. So if you've got kids, what advice can you give to parents to get them to be more like us?
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit, Steve and I talk every morning, and he gives me lots of great pointers. But, you know, you have to be inventive. Just getting them to question things, meaning, like, you sit down, and instead of telling them, you ask them questions. Don't tell them what it is. Say, well, why do you think this is this way, whatever. You know, if you just start asking them questions and get their wheels turning on anything. You know, like, when I comb my daughter's hair, She watches Peppa Pig on my phone because it keeps her still. She's got hair like my wife who's sitting right here, like really curly, and it's painful. But so we got to kind of like, here, watch Peppa Pig. And I'll always ask her, why did Daddy Pig do that? You know, just putting questions into her head to make her think outside of the box a little bit.
Yeah, if they ask you a question, that's a great opportunity to reflect it back at them. That's always what I did. That's, you know, the Socratic method or whatever, but it works. My favorite example, my daughter asked me one day, what color were dinosaurs? Which is a great kid question, right? It's like kids ask sometimes really fantastic questions because they don't know enough to think that the question is dumb, right? To them, every question is legitimate. And I could have given the short answer, you know, brown or whatever, or we don't know, but instead I just asked her, how could we know what color the dinosaurs were? Let's just bring it to that level. And she was like 3 or 4, but she was perfectly able to engage on her own level with that idea. You turn it into an exploration, right? And by the way, we do have a chapter on this in the book, how to be, you know, skeptical parenting, how to raise skeptical kids.
And then you made her write a paper on it, right?
Yeah. No, but the thing is, obviously kids love interactions with their parents until they become teenagers. But then they may still like it. Then teenagers are different. We don't want to stereotype teenagers. But, you know, if you make it fun, make it engaging. And the other sort of big lesson that I learned is that just whenever, if they show a flicker of passion about anything, run with that. Because it doesn't really matter what they're interested in. It could be anything. You show them the value of investing their time in understanding something, of knowledge, of categorization. There's a lot of generic skills that they will learn, even if it's baseball or whatever. It doesn't matter really what it is. And you can engage with them about the thing that they're passionate about on a skeptical level. Like everyone knows my daughter and I are into birding. And when the whole ivory-billed woodpecker thing hit, that was gold, because she was fascinated. Does it exist or not? There are some people who think they took a picture of it, but the other people say that they didn't. She was already into birds. You could pretty much teach all of skepticism on that one example, you know, if you just have a conversation about it.
What I do is you say to kids, do you know what skepticism is? And they say no. And you punch them hard. And they say, why did you do that? And you say, that's skepticism.
How many kids do you have, Richard?
None. Not now, anyway. Taken away. A person with a blue top on here. Yes. What's your question? A fantastic point. It's going to be our final question, so we're going to end on some optimism.
The media, and social media, et cetera, has been a hugely positive thing for our movement as well, because I remember a conversation we had a long time ago, Richard, at one of the TAMs, where you said, I think the skeptical movement's punching way above its weight. And I never really had thought about it.
I meant it literally with kids.
Yeah.
That's what I was.
But now I know what you're referring to. I agreed with that because it's given us the ability to enter into the conversation with so many more people. I mean, like, our little organization was transformed by social media. We went from publishing a newsletter for 200 people to having 120,000, 130,000 people listening to us. That's because of social media. So we have the ability to do it, but at the same time, the challenges became harder too. So it's like we have more of an ability to promote science and skepticism, but we're also facing more challenges, so we have to work even harder at it, I think. But I do think that we have the ability to change the world. I do. And I think we're learning how to do that. We keep upping our game. And I think we'll make progress.
There are plenty of examples, too. I mean, look at what the great work the skeptics in Australia have done with their anti-vax movement.
Yeah.
I mean, they've really, really punched that, nailed them way down into
our Marsh.
Marshall
is
the Good Thinking Society, right? There's been lots of successes. I think we just have to keep going.
And on a more personal note, I'll give you some outside perspective. Like, my God, do you guys live in a beautiful country? You know how you like drive down the same road every day and you don't look at the building? Look at the building. Guys, oh my God. You have such a gorgeous, gorgeous country and the people are awesome. Like, that's something just to be happy about every day. You know, sometimes we just take everything for granted and we just complain about shit because we're frustrated or late for work or whatever. And it really, like, I've just been trying to do this thing where I slow down and I, you know, George and I were just talking about this. Instead of like thinking, oh, we got to get through this next gig and then we got to eat and then we got to go to bed. It's like, no, what are we doing right now? Just take that moment and try to be more in the moment with people and enjoy that. You know, like I had a conversation. We had a great conversation. I had 10 minutes with you to talk. And that was one of my favorite things that happened tonight. You know what I mean? Just because I had a chance to talk to someone and I really appreciate those moments. But you guys are doing it in such a cool place. The Highlands are awesome. You're so lucky.
And so just wrapping things up, the SGU, so you're obviously extremely popular still with the podcast, and now you've got an amazing book out. What's the future hold
I think we're done, right?
That's it.
For last show. Steve, you said we're done, right? We can, like, you know.
No, we are just beginning, Bob. Yeah. The spaceship has right. just been fueled. Right. The book is the fuel that has filled our spaceship. Now we're going to take off. Steve and I have been talking about it. I mean, we all talk about what do we want to do? What's our goal? We have some short-term goals and some long-term goals. Of course, the short-term goals are like, let's put out a book every year.
Every other year.
Yeah, you know, we want to always have a book in the queue. We're always working on something. The real long-term goals are that we want to petition government. We want lobbyists in government globally, right? I mean, you have companies hiring very slick people to represent a single company's best interest to the government. We're not a company, and we're not, you know, owned by 10 people. This is a movement that we all believe in globally. There's got to be hundreds of thousands of skeptics out there, right? And we, you know, think about it. We put a call out, and we get 150 people in this room. That's awesome. You know, 700 people at QED. TAM was up to 1,600 people showing up at TAM back in the day. Wow. There's a lot of us. And, you know, when the time is right, you know, if we can funnel the money to one or two people just to go petition governments at key times during key things, I think we could really move the needle.
Okay. Fantastic. We're going to end with a song from George. Before you do that song, George, if folks want to hear more about your other songs and work, everything, where can they go?
I have a podcast every week, geologicpodcast.com. There's no geology whatsoever. And I also have a thing I call a mixtape, which looks like the old cassette tape you used to have, those of you that remember cassette tapes. It's actually a thumb drive inside a cassette tape, 44 songs, almost 4 hours of music. Come see me. I'll have that right over here if you want to take some of these songs home. Actually, the ones I did tonight are on there. So.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. So I think we are going to hear from George, and then I will thank the SGU and George, and then Sean will say a few words, and you'll thank George, and then we can all finally go home. So over to you, George. Take it away.
I might have a special little guest at the end here as well. This is called When I Was Your Age. When I was your age, the phone was tied to the wall with a kinky, twisty, 3.5-foot cord. It's hard to believe, but it had a ring that could not be turned off or ignored. You couldn't choose the sound of the ring, it was just the sound. We called the phone, we never heard of a ringtone. Was your age? Our video games looked nothing like the illustration on the box. All of the graphics consisted of nothing more than simple lines and dots. Missiles were just a few pixels, and the jungle swinging guy, he was a stick figure. Yes, nothing bigger. When I was your age. When I was your age. Your age, we had this stuff called film. You would stick in a camera before you took a shot, and then you had to wait like a month until you could tell what pictures you got. You would hand the film to a guy in a parking lot who lived in a booth. Oh yes, it's the truth. When I was your age, you had to wait till the movie was either in the theater or on TV. If you wanted adventure, you couldn't rent adventure, you just had to wait and see. And once you were watching, you couldn't stop or pause or even try to rewind. But hey, we didn't mind. When I was your age. When I was your age. Grown up,
singing from the stage. I bet you can't believe I was ever your age. I was your age. When I was your age, I loved watching Star Wars, but I hear you like Star Wars more than me. I wanted to be Indiana Jones, and Dr. Jones is who you aspire to be. And I loved playing with Lego, and Lego are what you currently build and rearrange. I guess some things never change. When I was your age, I didn't like doing homework, but when it was finished, it always felt real good. I didn't like brushing my teeth, but I brushed my teeth because Bert and Ernie said that I should. I didn't like listening to Mom, though I knew deep inside it was the right thing to do. And hey, so do you. You know what's true before you can say boo. My age too. You might not know that Cara Santa Maria sings. We're going to bring Cara up to sing something for you all. It's a very obscure song. You might not know it.
I don't think they will. So I have to admit, I haven't sung in public in about a decade. I'm literally shaking a bit, but we'll see if we can pull this off. Maybe you can even give me the first note or two. There we go. Sing the first line of me, George.
By yon bonny banks and by yon bonny braes, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and my true love were never wont to gay, on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. Oh, ye'll take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore. But me and my true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. All together now, ready?
Together now!
Yeah. You'll take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland glory. For me and my true love
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.